Chapter 11. Finally, he even got up and went to one of the front windows looking down into the square, because if Monday was stock auction and trade day, then Saturday was certainly radio and automobile day. On Monday, they were mostly men, and they drove in and parked the cars and trucks around the square and went straight to the sales barns and stayed there until time to come back to the square and eat dinner, and then went back to the sales barns and stayed there until time to come and get in the cars and trucks and drive home before full dark. But not Saturday. They were men and women and children too then, and the old people and the babies and the young couples to buy the licenses for the weddings and the country churches tomorrow. Come in to do a week's shopping for staples and delicacies like bananas and 25-cent sardines and machine-made cakes and pies and clothes and stockings and feed and fertilizer and plow gear. Which didn't take long for any of them, and no time at all for some of them, so that some of the cars never really became permanently stationary at all, and within an hour or so, many of the others had joined them, moving steadily, processional, and quite often in second gear because of their own density, round and round the square. Then out to the end of the tree-dense residential streets, to turn and come back and circle round and round the square again, as if they had come all the way in from the distant circumambient settlements and crossroads stores and isolate farms for that one purpose of enjoying the populace, coming and going, and motion, and recognizing one another, and the zephyr-like smoothness of the paved streets and alleys themselves, as well as looking at the neat, new painted small houses among their minute, neat yards and flower beds, and garden ornaments, which in the last few years had come to line them as dense as sardines or bananas. As a result of which, the radios had to play louder than ever through their supercharged amplifiers to be heard above the mutter of exhausts and swish of tires and the grind of gears and the constant horns, so that long before you even reached the square, you not only couldn't tell where one began and another left off, but you didn't even have to try to distinguish what any of them were playing or trying to sell you. But this one seemed to be even a Saturday among Saturdays, so that presently his uncle had got up from behind the table and come to the other window too, which was why they happened to see Lucas before he reached the office, though that was not yet. He was still standing, so he thought, alone at the window looking down into the square, thronged and jammed as he couldn't remember it before. The bright, sunny, almost hot air heavy with the smell of blooming locust from the courthouse yard. The sidewalks dense and massed and slow with people black and white come into town today as if by concert to collect at compound and so discharge not merely from balance but from remembering too that other Saturday only 7 days ago of which they had been despoiled by an old Negro man who had got himself into the position where they had had to believe he had murdered a white man. That Saturday and Sunday and Monday, only a week past, yet which might never have been since nothing of them remained. Vincent and his brother Crawford, in his suicide's grave, and strangers would be asking for weeks yet what sort of jail and sheriff Yoknapatawpha County had, where a man locked in it for murder could still get hold of a Luger pistol, even if it didn't have but one bullet in it, and for that many weeks nobody in Yoknapatawpha County would still be able to tell him, side by side near their mother's headstone in Caledonia Churchyard, and Jake Montgomery over in Crossman County, where somebody probably claimed him, too, for the same reason somebody did Crawford, and Miss Habersham sitting in her own hall now, mending the stockings until time to feed the chickens, and Alexander down there on the square in a flash Saturday shirt and a pair of zoot pants and a handful of peanuts or bananas, too, and he standing at the window, watching the dense, unhurried, unhurryable throng, and the busy, almost ubiquitous flash and gleam on Willie Ingram's cap badge, but mostly, and above all, the motion and the noise, the radios and the automobiles. The jukebox is in the drugstore, and the pool hall, and the cafe, and the bellowing amplifiers on the outside walls, not only of the record and sheet music store, but the Army and Navy supply store, and both feed stores, that they might falter. Somebody standing on a bench in the courthouse yard making a speech into another one with a muzzle like a siege gun bolted to the top of an automobile. Not to mention the ones which would be running in the apartments and the homes where the housewives and the maids made up the beds and swept and prepared to cook dinner so that nowhere inside the town's uttermost ultimate corporate rim should man, woman, or child, citizen, or guest, or stranger be threatened with 1 second of silence. And the automobiles, because explicitly speaking he couldn't see the square at all, only the dense, impenetrable mass of tops and hoods moving in double line at a snail's crawl around the square in a sharp, invisible aura of carbon monoxide and blatting horns and a light, intermittent clashing of bumpers, creeping slowly, one by one, into the streets leading away from the square, while the other opposite line crept as slowly, one by one, into it. So dense and slow, doweled into one interlocked mosaic, so infinitesimal of movement as to be scarcely worthy of the word that you could have crossed the square walking on them. Or even out to the edge of town, for that matter, or even on a horse, for that matter. Highboy, for instance, to whom the 5 or 6 foot jump from one top across the intervening hood to the next top would have been nothing. Or say the more or less motionless tops were laid with one smooth, continuous surface of planks like a bridge, and not Highboy, but a gated horse, or a horse with one gate. A hard-driving rack, 7 feet in the air like a bird, and traveling fast as a hawk or an eagle, with a feeling in the pit of his stomach as if a whole bottle of hot soda pop had exploded in it, thinking of the gallant, the splendid, the really magnificent noise a horse would make racking in any direction on a loose plank bridge 2 miles long, when suddenly his uncle at the other window said, "The American really loves nothing but his automobile. Not his wife, his child, nor his country, nor even his bank account first. In fact, he doesn't really love that bank account nearly as much as foreigners like to think, because he will spend almost any or all of it for almost anything, provided it is valueless enough, but his motor car. Because the automobile has become our national sex symbol. We cannot really enjoy anything unless we can go up an alley for it. Yet our whole background and raising and training forbids the sub rosa and surreptitious. So we have to divorce our wife today in order to remove from our mistress the odium of mistress, in order to divorce our wife tomorrow, in order to remove from our mistress, and so on. As a result of which, the American woman has become cold and undersexed. She has projected her libido onto the automobile not only because its glitter and gadgets and mobility pander to her vanity and incapacity, because of the dress decreed upon her by the National Retailers Association to walk, but because it will not maul her and tousle her, get her all sweaty and disarranged. So in order to capture and master anything at all of her anymore, the American man has got to make that car his own. Which is why, let him live in a rented rat hole, though he must, he will not only own one, but renew it each year in pristine virginity, lending it to no one, letting no other hand ever know the last secret, forever chaste, forever wanton intimacy of its pedals and levers, having nowhere to go in it himself, and even if he did, he would not go where scratch or blemish might deface it, spending all Sunday morning washing and polishing and waxing it, because in doing that, he is caressing the body of the woman who has long since denied him her bed. "That's not true," he said. "I am 50-plus years old," his uncle said. "I spent the middle 15 of them fumbling beneath skirts. My experience was that few of them were interested in love or sex either. They wanted to be married. I still don't believe it, he said. That's right, his uncle said. Don't. And even when you are 50 and plus, still refuse to believe it. And that was when they saw Lucas crossing the square, probably at the same time. The cocked hat and the thin, fierce glint of the tilted gold toothpick, and he said, Where do you suppose it was all the time? I never did see it. Surely he had it with him that afternoon, a Saturday when he was not only wearing that black suit, but he even had the pistol. Surely he never left home without the toothpick, too. Didn't I tell you? His uncle said. That was the first thing he did when Mr. Hampton walked into Skipworth's house where Skipworth had Lucas handcuffed to the bedpost. Gave Hampton the toothpick and told him to keep it until he called for it. Oh, he said. He's coming up here. Yes, his uncle said. To gloat. Oh, he said quickly. He's a gentleman. He won't remind me to my face that I was wrong. He's just going to ask me how much he owes me as his lawyer. Then in his chair beside the water cooler and his uncle once more behind the table, they heard the long, airy rumble and creak of the stairs, then Lucas's feet steadily, though with no haste. And Lucas came tieless and even colorless this time, except for the button, but with an old-time white waistcoat, not soiled so much as stained under the black coat and the worn gold loop of the watch chain. The same face which he had seen for the first time when he climbed dripping up out of the icy creek that morning 4 years ago, unchanged, to which nothing had happened since, not even age. In the act of putting the toothpick into one of the upper waistcoat pockets as he came through the door, saying generally, Gentlemen, and then to him, Young man, courteous and intractable, more than bland, downright cheerful almost, removing the raked swagger of the hat. You ain't fell in no more creeks lately, have you? That's right, he said. I'm saving that until you get some more ice on yours. You'll be welcome without waiting for a freeze, Lucas said. Have a seat, Lucas, his uncle said, but he had already begun to, taking the same hard chair beside the door which nobody else but Miss Habersham had ever chosen, a little akimbo as though he were posing for a camera, the hat laid crown up back across his forearm, looking at both of them still, and saying again, Gentlemen, you didn't come here for me to tell you what to do, so I'm going to tell you anyway, his uncle said. Lucas blinked rapidly once. He looked at his uncle. I can't say I did. Then he said cheerily, But I'm always ready to listen to good advice. Go and see Miss Habersham, his uncle said. Lucas looked at his uncle. He blinked twice this time. I ain't much of a visiting man, he said. You were not much of a hanging man either, his uncle said. But you don't need me to tell you how close you came. No, Lucas said. I don't reckon I do. What do you want me to tell her? You can't, his uncle said. You don't know how to say thank you. I've got that fixed, too. Take her some flowers. Flowers? Lucas said. I ain't had no flowers to speak of since Molly died. And that, too, his uncle said. I'll telephone home. My sister'll have a bunch ready. Chick'll drive you up in my car to get them and then take you out to Miss Habersham's gate. Never mind that, Lucas said. Once I got the flowers, I can walk. And you can throw the flowers away, too, his uncle said. But I know you won't do one, and I don't think you'll do the other in the car with Chick. Well, Lucas said, if won't nothing else satisfy you. And when he got back to town and finally found a place 3 blocks away to park the car and mounted the stairs again, his uncle was striking the match, holding it to the pipe and speaking through with into the smoke. You and Booker T. Washington. No, that's wrong. You and Miss Habersham and Alexander and Sheriff Hampton and Booker T. Washington, because he did only what everybody expected of him, so there was no real reason why he should have, while you all did not only what nobody expected you to, but all Jefferson and Yoknapatawpha County would have risen in active concord for once to prevent you if they had known in time, and even a year from now some, when and if they do at all, will remember with disapproval and distaste, not that you were ghouls, nor that you defied your color, because they would have passed either singly, but that you violated a white grave to save a nigger. So you had every reason why you should have. Just don't stop. And he... You don't think that just because it's Saturday afternoon again, somebody is hiding behind Miss Habersham's jasmine bush with a pistol aimed at her, waiting for Lucas to walk up to the front steps. Besides, Lucas didn't have his pistol today. And besides that, Crawford Gowrie... And his uncle. Why not? What's out yonder in the ground at Caledonia Church was Crawford Gowrie for only a second or two last Saturday. And Lucas Beecham will be carrying his pigment into 10,000 situations a wiser man would have avoided, and a lighter escaped 10,000 times, after what was Lucas Beecham for a second or so last Saturday is in the ground at his Caledonia Church, too. Because that Yoknapatawpha County, which would have stopped you and Alexander and Miss Habersham last Sunday night, are right, actually. Lucas's life, the breathing and eating and sleeping, is of no importance, just as yours and mine are not, but his unchallengeable right to it in peace and security. And in fact, this earth would be much more comfortable with a good deal fewer Beechams and Stevenses and Mallisons of all colors in it if there were only some painless way to efface, not the clumsy, room-devouring carcasses, which can be done, but the memory, which cannot. That inevitable, immortal memory, awareness of having once been alive, which exists forever, still 10,000 years afterward, in 10,000 recollections of injustice and suffering. Too many of us, not because of the room we take up, but because we are willing to sell liberty short at any tawdry price for the sake of what we call our own, which is a constitutional statutory license to pursue each his private postulate of happiness and contentment, regardless of grief and cost, even to the crucifixion of someone whose nose or pigment we don't like. And even these can be coped with, provided that few of others who believe that a human life is valuable simply because it has a right to keep on breathing, no matter what pigment its lungs distend or nose inhales the air, and are willing to defend that right at any price. It doesn't take many. Three were enough last Sunday night. Even one can be enough. And with enough ones willing to be more than grieved and shamed, Lucas will no longer run the risk of needing, without warning, to be saved. And he, maybe not three the other night. One and two halves would be nearer, right? And his uncle, I said it's all right to be proud. It's all right even to boast. Just don't stop. And came to the table and laid the hat on it, and took from the inside coat pocket a leather snap purse, patinaed like old silver, and almost as big as Miss Habersham's handbag, and said, I believe you got a little bill against me. What for? His uncle said. For representing my case, Lucas said. Name whatever your fee is within reason. I want to pay it. Not me, his uncle said. I didn't do anything. I sent for you, Lucas said. I authorized you. How much do I owe you? Nothing, his uncle said. Because I didn't believe you. That boy there is the reason you're walking around today. Now Lucas looked at him, holding the purse in one hand and the other hand poised to unsnap it. The same face to which it was not that nothing had happened, but which had simply refused to accept it. Now he opened the purse. All right, I'll pay him. And I'll have you both arrested, his uncle said. You for corrupting a minor and him for practicing law without a license. Lucas looked back to his uncle. He watched them staring at one another. Then once more Lucas blinked twice. All right, he said. I'll pay the expenses then. Name your expenses at anything within reason and let's get this thing settled. Expenses? His uncle said. Yes, I had an expense sitting here last Tuesday trying to write down all the different things you finally told me in such a way that Mr. Hampton could get enough sense out of it to discharge you from the jail. And so the more I tried it, the worse it got. And the worse it got, the worse I got, until when I came to again, my fountain pen was sticking up on its point in the floor down here like an arrow. Of course, the paper belongs to the county, but the fountain pen was mine, and it cost me $2 to have a new point put in it. You owe me $2. $2? Lucas said. He blinked twice again. Then he blinked twice again. Just $2? Now he just blinked once. Then he did something with his breath. Not a sigh, simply a discharge of it, putting his first two fingers into the purse. That don't sound like much to me, but then I'm a farming man and you're a lawing man, and whether you know your business or not, I reckon it ain't none of my red wagon, as the music box says, to try to learn you different. And drew from the purse a worn bill crumpled into a ball, not much larger than a shriveled olive, and opened it enough to read it, then opened it out and laid it on the desk, and from the purse took a half dollar and laid it on the desk, then counted onto the desk from the purse, one by one, 4 dimes and 2 nickels, and then counted them again with his forefinger, moving them one by one about half an inch, his lips moving under the mustache, the purse still open in the other hand. Then he picked up 2 of the dimes and a nickel and put them into the bag holding the open purse and took from the purse a quarter and put it on the desk and looked down at the coins for a rapid second, then put the 2 dimes and the nickel back on the desk and took up the half dollar and put it back into the purse. That ain't but 6 bits, his uncle said. Never mind that, Lucas said, and took up the quarter and dropped it back into the purse and closed it. And watching Lucas, he realized that the purse had at least 2 different compartments and maybe more. A second, almost elbow-deep section opening beneath Lucas's fingers, and for a time Lucas stood looking down into it exactly as you would look down at your reflection in a well. Then took from the compartment a knotted, soiled cloth tobacco sack, bulging and solid-looking, which struck on the desktop with a dull, thick chink. That makes it out, he said. 4 bits in pennies. I was aiming to take them to the bank, but you can save me the trip. You want to count them? Yes, his uncle said. But you're the one paying the money. You're the one to count them. It's 50 of them, Lucas said. This is business, his uncle said. So Lucas unknotted the sack and dumped the pennies out on the desk and counted them one by one, moving each one with his forefinger into the first small mass of dimes and nickels, counting aloud, then snapped the purse shut and put it back inside his coat, and with the other hand shoved the whole mass of coins and the crumpled bill across the table until the desk blotter stopped them, and took a bandana handkerchief from the side pocket of the coat and wiped his hands and put the handkerchief back and stood again intractable and calm and not looking at either of them now, while the fixed blaring of the radios and the blatting creep of the automobile horns and all the rest of the whole county's Saturday uproar came up on the bright afternoon. Now what? His uncle said. What are you waiting for now? My receipt, Lucas said.